I do not like that. Good evening. My name is Jeff. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so much, Paul. That was a really good story. I really related, especially to the part about not liking speaking. So when I initially got sober, my sponsor said there's a list of things you got to say every time that you speak. The first thing is you thank the person who asked you to speak. So thank you, Nikki. It's an honor and a privilege at any time I'm asked to speak for Alcoholics Anonymous. The second thing I'm supposed to say is my sobriety day, which is July 30th of 2012, which means that I just celebrated 10 years. I would love to stand up here and tell you all that I'm full of virtue because I was able to stay sober for 10 years, but the truth is that I was beaten into a state of reasonableness. This was not my choice. This isn't what I would have done, but it was really the only choice I had. I also have a home group. This is my home group, the Tampa YPG. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I sponsor others. In fact, I just brought a guy through the fourth step 2 weekends ago, the fifth step 2 weekends ago, and it's a pretty wonderful part of this program. So what I'm supposed to do is I'm supposed to tell everyone what it was like, what happened, what it's like now, by sharing my experience, strength, and hope. The central thesis of my entire statement tonight is going to be that I've tried to quit drinking and I couldn't. I tried to quit drinking a lot, often, and I could not. I would always find myself drinking again. So what I'm supposed to do is I'm supposed to start at the beginning. So I was born in Minnesota. I grew up in South Dakota, a real rural town, 15,000 people. But I wasn't in the country. I was still in a town. And my parents didn't have the necessary skills. They weren't equipped with whatever they needed to raise children. My childhood was fairly traumatic. They weren't trying to mess me up. They just did the best they could with what they had, and what they had was alcoholism and mental health issues. There was a period of time, actually. I raised my sister for a period of time, and I have a really good relationship with her. So, I mean, through all that the terrible things that happened to me, it resulted in me having a really good relationship with my sister. So that's a positive part of that. But so when I was, 10, 11, 12, something like that, my mother, who's very good at diagnosing other people, but terrible at diagnosing herself, I share that trait with her. She said, look at your father, look at the way he drinks, he's an alcoholic. If you don't ever want to be an alcoholic, you can't drink. And I mean, I saw his behavior, just an absolute brilliant man when he was sober, but it just like hardly ever happened. And yeah, I saw his behavior and I didn't want that. Consequently, I didn't drink until I was 17 years old. But I needed a drink way, way before that. I was like a really, like super weird kid. I felt, you know, I've heard people get up here and say, I felt like my skin didn't fit, or I felt like I was, I was absent the day of school that they handed out the instruction manual to life. It's just like, it seemed like everyone else had it figured out, and I just did not. I've read a lot, and I played video games, and I actually played a lot of sports. In fact, I, through the lens of sobriety, I came to the conclusion that I kind of used sports as a kind of like alcohol light. It required me to be in the moment. Like I couldn't worry about what had happened 5 minutes ago. I couldn't worry about what was going to happen in 5 minutes. I had to like focus on the now, it got me to the point where eventually I would drink. So I was 17 years old, and a friend of mine approached me, and I don't know why, like this day, because I was very convinced that I didn't want to drink. And this friend approached me and he asked me if I wanted to share a bottle of whiskey with him. And I didn't know anything about it. I saw lots of people drink, my dad drank, his friends drank, but I didn't know that, like, you don't start out on whiskey. But my mind, so, and I mean, this is, again, through the lens of sobriety, I'm able to understand that this is not how normal people think. I didn't say, yeah, let's share a bottle of whiskey. I asked him to get me one of my own. And again, I didn't know anything about it. So, can you hand me that water? So, he got me a bottle of whiskey, and I drank the entire thing. I think it was like a fifth or something. It was a real small bottle of whiskey. And I drank the entire thing that night, and I blacked out. Now, I've heard lots of people get up here at the podium and say, oh, you know, I started drinking when I was 13, and by the time I was 17, I was blacking out. Which leads me to believe that this is a progressive disease. My alcoholism was progressing, whether I was drinking or not. And by the time I was 17, I was going to be blacking out no matter what. But I do remember that it was, so like all that anxiety and all that, you know, my skin not fitting and, not having the instruction manual to life, all that went away, and it went away like real quick. Yeah, of course I drank like shots of whiskey out of a bottle, so. But it went away very, very quickly, and like I could take a full breath. Like I could fill my lungs completely with air, and it was fairly amazing. And I took note of that. Like, you know, of course I couldn't start drinking every single day at that point, but you know, I was 17, so I wasn't far from it. And so I knew at that point, like, this is something that is really going to be involved in my life, is drinking and, you know, just feeling okay, was really what I wanted. So I grew up fairly poor. We were, you know, we had to move like every 9 months or so, because we just kept getting evicted. So I wanted to get out, you know, I had this plan. I was going to go to college, and then I was going to be able to make some money, and then I wasn't going to be, you know, poor anymore. I don't know. But my plan was I was going to join the National Guard, and I was going to get a bunch, you know, they were going to pay for my college. They did not, by the way. that was a scam. I was 17. This wasn't long after I had my first drink. I forged my mother's signature, because I wasn't 18, to join the National Guard. And then I graduated from high school. I went to basic training, then I went to college. And at this point, my drink, you know, I started understanding that how great the drinking really made me feel. And I started playing rugby, which, you know, like I was pretty good in sports, and that was the perfect combination of drinking and sports. And it was, you know, I really ran with that. So on my 21st birthday, I had been going, I had a fake ID, and I had been going into this bar for forever, but I went in. And in North Dakota at the time, the bars closed at 1 o'clock in the morning, and between midnight and 1 o'clock on your birthday, it was called your power hour, and you know, you tried to have as many shots as you could. And I had an obscene amount of shots, and I blacked out. And the next day, I woke up, I don't know, noon or 3 o'clock, whatever. And I went into that same bar just to have a drink or something, and the owner said, "You're late." And I was like, "For what?" And he said, you're going to be working the door tonight. I gave you a job last night." And I I ended up working the door, and I ended up as a bartender, and I made a ton of money. So like with the National Guard probably should have paid for a lot of my school, and you know, I was making like just in the year 2003 or so, I just make just ridiculous money. All this should have paid for my school, but that's not what happened. What happened is I took out a bunch of loans and just drank and just did whatever I wanted to do. Because that's really what alcohol did for me. It allowed me to do whatever I wanted to do right at that moment. It allowed me to just to talk to whomever I wanted to talk to, say whatever I wanted to say, and you know, it just allowed me to live in the moment. So I got that job, and this is really when it started working well for me. So when I would drink for a long time. I thought everyone loved me. I thought that I was real, real cool. And to be honest, I probably was just a jerk to everyone, and everyone hated me. But that's not how I saw it. And that, you know, of course the booze is affecting my perception of the whole world. And consequently, I think this is really where my mental obsession took root. So like, whenever I was romancing a drink, or even, like to this day, when I think about it, it isn't, waking up in the morning and trying to take a shot and retching it up, and then taking a shot and retching it up just so I can get one shot down so I can drink for the rest of the day. I think about when I was 20 years old or when I was 21 years old, when it was really working well, and I thought I was having lots of fun, and I thought I was the life of the party. So anyways, I'm going to school, and I guess September 11th happened, and then they deployed me. And kind of like my childhood, I don't know whether that would have been traumatic for anybody else, but I know that it was traumatic for me. And when I got back, I there was just one point where I was like, man, this hangover really sucks, and I don't want to deal with a hangover anymore. And I just started drinking through it, and that turned into around the clock drinking, and that wrecked me fairly quick. I got charged with a DUI. I guess it would have been like it was soon after that, maybe 6 months after I got back from Iraq. And actually, so when I was 20 years old, I got charged with 3 minors in consumption. That was like a really big thing back in South and North Dakota. They just kept like charging me, they just kept hassling me and charging me with like being under 21 and drinking. And I just kept doing it. And they took away my driver's license and like a bunch of jerks. So I also should mention that I was, I guess, born Catholic. I don't know what that really means other than my mother would drag me to church when I was a kid. And then by the time I was like, I don't know, probably around 12 or so, I started to see the behavior of the people that, really claimed to be religious, and, it didn't comport with whatever I thought was, godly. And I just cast that aside, and I thought, there just can't be a God. That's dumb. And I really didn't put much more thought into it until years and years later. And then I was convinced I was an atheist very convinced I was an atheist. I couldn't be wrong. So I got back from my deployment. I started drinking myself to death, and I found myself on the dorm room floor, I guess DTing. I don't know how bad it was. Like, it was real bad. I thought it was real bad, but who knows? Like, I could just be a wimp. And that is a distinct possibility. And I thought I was gonna die, and so I got done with that, and I was like, and I probably should say, I started drinking when I was 17, and I was probably trying to quit for the first time when I was 20. Like, I had identified that it's pretty easy to identify in my life, like, geez, this is the thing that's wrecking everything. So I'd been trying to quit, you know, from the time I was 20 to the time I was, this happened when I was 26 or something. But I get back, I detox on my, DTs on my dorm room floor, and I think, man, that sucked. I'm never going to do that again. I'm just never going to drink again. Like, that's all I got to do is not drink again, and I'll never have to experience that. And it went maybe like 4 months, and then I drank again. And I remember thinking, like, this is probably not going to end well, but, you know, I just kind of, like, forgot about it, and it didn't end up, like, wrecking my life right away. You know, it took some time, but, you know, it happened. And I graduated from college with a degree in air traffic control. And I was stationed down in Tampa from Grand Forks, North Dakota, is where I went to school. This is actually through the lens of sobriety. I ended up quitting that job, and the reason I quit is because I couldn't drink the way that I wanted to. So the rule was 12 hours bottle to throttle. That was kind of the rule. And I knew that if I drank at all, there's no way that I was going to be able to drink successfully, you know, 12 hours before a shift. And the way that the shifts were set up is like, this is just an example, Monday at 8 o'clock, Tuesday at 10 o'clock, Wednesday at noon, and so forth. So really what had ended up happening is I only had one day of the week that I could drink, and I would black out every single time. But the problem was I didn't know what was wrong. I was ready to crawl out of my skin, and I didn't understand why. And the reason was I couldn't drink as often as I, you know, needed to. You know, I was just I was in rough shape. So I did what anybody else would do. I had a degree in air traffic control that's really not usable in any in any other fashion, so I quit. And I went to I went up to North Dakota to work on the oil rigs in Western North Dakota. Now, I don't know if any of you know any roughnecks, but this job was perfect for someone like me, so who has a problem with drinking. What I would do is you'd do an entire hitch or a week on of 7 days, and I wouldn't drink at all during that week, and then an entire week off. And I was making just stupid money, and I was just, you know, spending, you know, just a ridiculous amount of money on this week off, doing whatever I wanted, and, you know, just drinking my face off. And I remember feeling just a few hitches after starting that. Like, this is so much better than being an air traffic controller. This is just the best. And actually, eventually, that rig stacked up. It was in 2008, and the oil prices were going crazy. And I ended up getting a job as a collector for a credit card company. So this is kind of the part of my story where I talk about how, you know, in more about alcoholism, it says, you know, I try to limit the number of drinks. I tried to drink beer only. You know, I tried to do this. I tried to get the right. And on some level, I knew that if I just felt better, I wouldn't need to drink like the way that I do, and I wouldn't need to continue to wreck my life. You know, so I would try to get the right car, the right girlfriend, or, you know, get the right job, or I'd move. I moved 10 times. You know, I was in Texas and Washington, North Dakota, Florida, back to North Dakota, Minnesota. You know, I was just all over the place. And the problem was I just kept bringing me with me, and I did not like the way that I felt. And again, this is through the lens of sobriety. I didn't understand it at the time, but I really just could not figure out what was wrong with me that I had to continue to burn my life down like this. And all the time, this whole time, I'm trying to quit drinking. And so eventually I moved back down to Florida. I go to Naples, and I quit drinking. And again, so each time the detox gets worse, and it you know, each time I'm like, man, I'm just never going to drink again. If I just don't drink again, I never have to experience that again. And inevitably, I would find myself with a drink in my hand again. You know, it was uncanny. You know, and our literature talks about that a little bit. You know, so I suffer from the physical craving. When I have a drink, it demands another. You know, I'm 10 times more likely to have the second drink. I'm 100 times more likely to have the third drink. But if that was my only problem, it would be just academic. I just wouldn't have that first drink. The problem is, the real kick in the teeth is that I always drink again. I did the appropriate field research, and then I will drink again. And it's like, I don't want to. If you give me a lie detector test, I'll tell you I don't want to drink again. And then I do. And it's baffling. I can't understand it. So I moved down to Naples. I get sober again, and I get sober for about another 4 months. I had 9 months for a period of time. So I mean, I tried to get sober a bunch, not with Alcoholics Anonymous. I never tried Alcoholics Anonymous until this time. I had 9 months. I had 4 months. I had 4 months again, and then I was playing I was actually at the national championships for D2 a rugby club, and somehow I found myself with a beer in my hand, and I was drinking it again, and I like it's just so frustrating because. I guess I was kind of raised with the idea that if a man wants to do something, or if a person wants to do something, they're just going to do it. Like, I don't need any help with anything. Just make a decision and do it. And that had actually worked on a lot of different aspects of my life, but it couldn't work on this. It just did not work. You know, and again, the central thesis of my state, my talk tonight is that I tried to quit drinking and I just couldn't. So I started drinking again, and it was a 3-month spiral. It was real quick, and I was back in the situation, and I was like, I was engaging in really dangerous behavior, because what I was trying to do is I was trying to kill myself. I wasn't brave enough to use a noose or a gun, but what I wanted is just like, I wanted it to just be over. I would look at the ceiling and I would roll my eyes because I'd woken up. I just didn't want to wake up. It was just so painful. That had happened before, but this time it was just more than I could bear. I was dating this girl, and she talked to somebody else she knew, and this guy named Boston Sean brought me to my first meeting, and I'd never been to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd never even considered it. I thought that was, you know, self-help or something. I don't know. Like, my thought was, if I want to do something, I'll just do it. I don't need any help with it. So Sean brought me to my first meeting, and the very first meeting I remember, there was a guy who had 4 months of sobriety, and he had been in and out, and he said he was couch surfing. He was living on his friends' couches, and he was happy. He was laughing. He was like, you know, joking around with people, and I was just sitting there with my arms crossed, and, you know, like just pain on my face, I suspect. But I was just in so much pain. They said, hey, and what I thought was, okay, here's the deal. I'll try Alcoholics Anonymous. It sounds dumb to me, but whatever. And I'll really give it a full faith effort. And if it doesn't work, then I can just go back and, you know, basically kill myself. And so they said, go to a meeting every day. And I was like, that does seem a bit extreme. But they said to get a sponsor. So I was really picky. They said, find somebody who has what you want. And I didn't really even know what it is that I wanted. I just didn't want to feel that way anymore. There was a guy who spoke at a meeting, and afterwards in the parking lot, I approached him, and I was like, in the I was kicking around a rock. I was like, hey, do you have any time to like maybe work with people? And he said, are you trying to ask me a question? And I said, well, I was just wondering if like, you know, you were taking on sponsees. He asked me, are you trying to ask me a question? And this went on for, it felt like 5 minutes. I'm sure it was just like 20 seconds or something. But eventually, somehow, he got out of me, like, hey, will you be my sponsor? And he said, yes, it would be my honor. What lengths are you willing to go to stay sober? And at that point, I had never really like thought about that. And for some reason, I told him, I said, I'm willing to go to any length to stay sober. And he said, good. Remember you said that. Because I'm going to ask you to do stuff you don't want to do. You know, and then he started going through the list. You know, you've got to go to a meeting every day until you get well. And I remember just bristling with intent. Like, that's really extreme. And he said, literally, like 3 minutes ago or 10 minutes ago, you just told me you were willing to go to any lengths. And now you're saying that you can't go to a meeting every day? And, I mean, he did kind of have me there. But he said, get a home group and get a commitment at the home group. And, you know, we're going to work the steps. And he sat me down. We had a standing appointment every week. We would go to a meeting and then go. We would work for, I mean, it wasn't real long, 2 hours, 3 hours. We read the book from the doctor's opinion through. And when a step came up, we did it. Now, at this point, like I said, I was an atheist. And I remember saying, I don't think this is going to work because I'm an atheist. And he said, don't worry about that. We're not at step two yet. I don't know why you're even, why you're worried about that. And when we got to We Agnostics, and he just looked at me afterwards and he said, all right, it's time to do step two. And you can pick anything, and anything is your higher power. It just can't be you. And I just remember thinking, oh, I guess I can do that. That's not crazy. You know, and I had read the first 164 a ton by that point. But, you know, there's a part in Bill's story where it says, you know, the icy intellectual mountain melted. I was free at last. Well, I really wasn't free at last, but at least, like, just I had that little iota of willingness. And that was, turns out, all that was necessary. So I did my fourth and fifth step. On my fifth step, there were things that I didn't want. In fact, I had not written them down, and I was going to leave them out. And you know, afterwards he stopped and he looked at me and he said, "Is there anything else? Because you know this might mean the difference between you drinking or not." And you know, I remember thinking, man, I'm going to give this a full faith effort. And you know, I shared those things with him. And you know, nothing bad happened. He just nodded his head, and then we moved on. You know, I remember, and so I suffered from the mental obsession. Like I couldn't tell that I was getting better. My sponsor and everyone around me, all my AA friends kept telling me, man, you're getting better. And I couldn't see it. And eventually, about a year, I was done with the steps. I was able to sponsor, and I was at an airport in Atlanta, and there were thunderstorms everywhere, and I had like this internship that I needed to be at the next day, and everyone was just screaming at the gate agents, and it was bedlam and chaos, and just like it was, you know, it was crazy, and this overwhelming sense of peace came over me, and it was just like I couldn't describe it, and you know, I'm sure that I was getting better up till that point, but I didn't recognize it. You know, and I'd been sober a year at that point. That was the longest I'd ever been sober. But it just took me a real long time. You know, and in that time, there was a day that I went, and I didn't think about drinking. And for someone like me, that was pretty great. You know, and then there was a week. You know, and then after that sometime, there was a month. So I got sober, and then we all live happily ever after, and that's, Yeah, so that's not how it works. So the universe keeps coming at me. Just because I got sober doesn't mean that bad or good things aren't going to happen. The universe has never forsaken me. You know, I thought that it might a few times, and I've gotten well and worse in sobriety. You know, I tried to do geographical cures in sobriety because I didn't like the way that I felt. You know, I moved back up to North Dakota for a while, and then I moved back down to Tampa, which is coincidentally when I moved to Tampa, I was working downtown, and I was working till late, till 7 or 7:30 or whatever, and I just happened to walk over to this meeting, and the welcome I got was pretty outstanding, and you know, I knew right then that I was going to make my home group. This is a group full of people who actually take sponsorship, and they do the deal. It's people who are serious about staying sober. I'd moved back to Tampa now, and I'm working, or I'm YPG is my home group. And my wife got real sick. Actually, at the time, she was my fiance. She needed a kidney transplant. And it was a real difficult time in my life. And I remember, you know, she was in kidney failure. And I called my sponsor. And he said, well, this is an opportunity for you to serve your wife. This is an opportunity for you to really show her what you've become. And that was the strategy that I took that entire time. And it was real difficult. It was real painful for her. It was real painful for me. One of those guys that I played rugby with all those years ago, one of my best friends in the entire world, he donated a kidney. He flew down from Bismarck, North Dakota, and donated a kidney to my wife. And God didn't forsake me. You know, and the whole time I selfishly was thinking, man, don't do this to me, don't do this to me. Things turn out all right, even when they're not all right. I have to be okay with whatever the universe gives me. So today, I get to sponsor people. I bring a meeting into detox. You know, I get to help people. When I did my 11th step, it became fairly clear to me that my higher power. I'm not real smart, and my higher power just basically says make the world a better place. Now, how you do that, it does turn out to be a little bit more difficult than just saying it out loud. But, you know, for someone like me, I'm an alcoholic. That's the best use of my time, is to help other alcoholics in some way. Because, like, just the amount of suffering that I went through, if there's other people out there that are even going through a portion of that, if I could help them, man, that would be, like, really making the world a better place. So the detoxes and, you know, sponsorship are real good ways for someone like me to help, to do something that makes the world better. And my life, I'm not happy all the time, but I'm not sad all the time either. You know, I've come a long way, but I'm nowhere near where I need to be. Again, thank you all for listening, and that's all I have. Thanks.